drug cartels may operate with far fewer rules than legitimate businesses, but they are still businesses, competing with rivals, affected by supply and demand, and drawn to any innovation that could make them more profitable. So when Chinese-American money launderers pioneered a system that cut the cost of that service from as much as 18% to as little as 1% of gross revenues, cartels eagerly signed on and made criminals with ties to the Chinese Communist Party major players in the North American drug trade. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. U.S. law enforcement agents had their work cut out for them trying to understand this transformation in international money laundering and taking those responsible out of commission. But they couldn't help but be fascinated by the elegance of this system that matched Chinese elites who wanted dollars with cartel bosses eager to make their profits look legitimate. Sebastian Rotella is a senior reporter at ProPublica, where you can read his story, How a Chinese-American Gangster Transformed Money Laundering for Drug Cartels. Sebastian, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Before we get to this innovative new strategy for laundering illegal drug profits, maybe it's helpful to know how it worked before. So we're going to start before the beginning and ask, why is money laundering essential for drug cartels?
Money laundering is essential for drug cartels because they generate these huge amounts of cash, particularly on the streets of American cities, and then they have to figure out a way to make use of it and to get it into the legitimate economy in ways that they can, both for their own personal enrichment and to keep their organizations running and to buy weapons and to bribe police and politicians. And it's the ongoing fundamental challenge for drug cartels all over the world that has bedeviled them for decades.
What sort of system existed when Latin American cartels hired launderers from places like Lebanon and Colombia to make their money look legit?
You know, I covered the Mexican border in Latin America and covered drug trafficking for many years in the 1990s and some into the 2000s. And in that period, until about, say, 5 to 8 years ago, the system, a lot of it was bulk cash smuggling. So, say, take Chicago, you know, very important hub for drug dealing and drug trafficking. The Mexican cartels would send a lot of the money physically back to Mexico. And smuggle it across the border, and deposit the dollars either through peso exchanges, money houses, or often legitimate banks. Some of which got in big trouble as years went on, and investigators got onto this. But a lot of these dollars were being returning into the economy and being used through banks, and obviously through businesses and trade and things like that. As you said, Colombians became important specialists for the Mexican cartels, which became increasingly dominant, but Colombians retained a specialty. There was something that was called the black market peso exchange in Colombia, which was basically manipulation of foreign exchange and using legitimate businesses to launder money. And groups, as you said, connected to Lebanese groups, some of them even connected to the Hezbollah terrorist group, became big specialists and did a lot of service for Mexican and other Latin American cartels with very complex schemes that moved money around the world through various kinds of trade and even used banks like banks in Lebanon, which ended up getting sanctioned to move the money into the legitimate system. But the common denominator through all those years was that it was expensive. You know, they were charging as much as 18 cents on the dollar, and it took time. It took weeks and sometimes even months. And this exposed the cash, you know, these mountains of stockpiled cash, which we've seen, you know, in TV series and movies, to damage, to risk of confiscation, to ripoff. So it was just an ongoing headache and challenge and expense for the drug cartels that when the Chinese model appears, gets largely solved.
So, yeah, enter Xi Ji Li, this Chinese-born businessman who had moved to Baja California, just south of the U.S.-Mexican border as a kid. And his family there was in the restaurant business?
His family there was at least nominally in the restaurant business, but there's indications that at least one of his close relatives was also involved in that very thriving trade in smuggling of migrants and contraband at that border. That's a border I know well. I was based there, and there's a long time, one of the oldest and biggest Chinese communities in Mexico is there in Mexicali on the Mexican side of the border. Many people, obviously very legitimate business people, but there has always been an entrenched criminal presence that, you know, mixes with the with all the drug trafficking and immigrant smuggling and other things that go on there. So from a young age, Xi Ji Li, who, as you said, is kind of tricultural and trilingual, as many people are in that part of Baja California, you know, of Chinese descent. You know, he's a child in China. He spends formative years in Mexicali, and then he moves to Southern California and becomes a U.S. citizen. And he, at a young age, is already launched into drug trafficking, immigrant smuggling, and other kinds of criminality based, you know, using classic transborder infrastructure of different kinds of smuggling.
So Li is fluent in three languages and three cultures, but he also has these deep ties to relatives still in China. What do we know about how those relatives might have facilitated his connections to high-ranking members of the Chinese Communist Party?
One of the things that, you know, and as far as, I mean, one of the things that becomes clear is that he develops connections at an early age to one of the Chinese organized crime groups that's known as the 14K Triad, which is one of the most entrenched, powerful and worldwide Chinese organized crime groups. So that's a very important connection for him. And he also, because he's living in Mexico and speaks Spanish and spends a lot of time in Mexican and Latino communities, develops cartel ties, even through, at a certain point, he's married to a Chinese woman and he's married to a Mexican-American woman with ties to cartels. So he develops this mix, this international mix of criminal connections. And there's evidence that, you know, in the 2000s, as his business is starting to grow and he's based in Southern California, he already has connections to what are described as Chinese officials based in the United States with diplomatic status or diplomatic cover. So he already has some connections to people in the Chinese government, the Chinese establishment. And he's doing things like smuggling cocaine via Mexico to Hong Kong. He's smuggling cocaine to Canada. He's moving migrants from China through Cuba. He's doing things in places that are difficult, a real mix of places where you need connections and governments and mafias to survive, let alone to prosper as he did.
It's probably the least of our concerns at this point, but was he married to those two different women simultaneously?
It's a complex and messy situation, but he seemed to have had multiple marriages, wives, and families. Yes, it's kind of complicated. But what's interesting about it is that those, at least, you know, in several of those relationships were beneficial to his criminal career.
What do we know? How much formal education does this guy have?
He does not appear to have formal education. You know, his English is not very good. He was able to get by. His Spanish, I'm told that he spoke, what you would call fluent street Spanish. But he's someone who went to elementary and high school, you know, from say 10 to 16 in Mexico. So he's not extremely educated, but he certainly seems to have remarkable financial acumen and is making already, you know, and people who spent time with him, both associates and law enforcement in his 20s and 30s, he was always someone with multiple businesses on both sides of the border, with lots of cars, with a Rolex watch. I mean, he was doing well for himself at an early age and well launched. And already by 2008, he's the target of investigations by the DEA, the FBI, and the Los Angeles County Anti-Drug Task Force.
Yeah, federal agents had their first glimpse of these operations during this stakeout in Chicago's Chinatown. What did they observe happening there that made them think, oh, this is something new?
Well, that's a bit later, but that is more in the past decade. But what they see starting in the past 7 to 10 years or so is, you know, as I was describing before, there was a lot of money physically moving, a lot of bulk cash moving out of Chicago and being smuggled down to Mexico, and a certain amount of that would get intercepted. What the DEA and HSI agents who watched that aspect of the cartel's operation started seeing was that the money was, you know, cartel transporters of cash were driving the cash to a new neighborhood, which was Chinatown in Chicago, which was something they had never seen before. And they are doing these furtive exchanges in parking lots and motels and businesses with Chinese couriers. And this is fascinating and intriguing and unprecedented. And the more they watch, the more they see it. And the more reports start coming in from around the country that it's happening in Los Angeles and New York and Atlanta and just about wherever you can imagine that these cartel money transporters are turning their money over to Chinese couriers.
And importantly, these people that were getting hired as couriers were not like seasoned underworld operatives, right? Lee deliberately seems to have looked for people without any kind of criminal record.
That's right. You know, he runs, he almost gets caught in 2008 in Southern California. He runs to Mexico, establishes himself as a trafficker, but also increasingly gets into money laundering, and he deploys dozens of couriers around the United States. And as you said, these are not people carrying AK-47s. These are not even people often with criminal records. They are generally young Chinese immigrants. They work as Uber drivers. They work as waiters. They work in menial jobs. And they are also picking up, you know, they have businesses, small businesses. Many of them are women, but they are receiving, you know, huge amounts of cash, you know, millions of dollars, millions and millions of dollars from the mainly Mexican cartels in the United States. And the money is being laundered through this complex system that he has developed that encompasses the United States, China, and Latin America.
This is an interesting detail. That money often moved in approximately $350,000 increments because that's how much cash you can fit in a suitcase.
Right. It's like this. It's really an industry that's moving. Think of it as an industry that's moving this physical product that is money, right? And that was that was about the right amount. So often what they call these contracts would be these $350,000 loads that would, as you said, would fit in suitcases and that are often driven from to one of the two coasts, to California or to New York, because this scheme is based very much on the money being laundered through the Chinese elite. What Xi Ji Li does basically is this. He realizes there are two market forces he can bring together here. You have the Mexican and Latin American cartels, which are generating all these dollars, right, that they want to turn into pesos in Mexico to be able to launder and to use. And then the other force is this very wealthy elite that has developed in China, you know, over the past 20 years, as the biggest communist country in the world has become, you know, this bastion of savage capitalism. You have all these wealthy people who are desperate to get their fortunes out of China because of anti-corruption drives, because of political purges, because of many other reasons. They are desperate for dollars, and they are willing to lose money in order to get those dollars. So what Xi Ji Li's model is, he is willing to offer the cartels the best terms they've ever got. He's, you know, if they were paying up to 18% before, he's offering them extremely low commissions, like 1 or 2%. He's promising that he's going to deliver their money, not in weeks or months, but, you know, within a couple of days or a day. And he's even guaranteeing them that if a load is lost, he's going to replace that load for free. He's able to offer those great deals to the cartels and basically, you know, blow away the competition because he's making the money off of the wealthy Chinese who are essentially acquiring that drug cash in the United States. And then those wealthy Chinese are doing, at his direction, transactions in China. You know, all this money is flowing through the Chinese economy, Chinese banks, Chinese businesses, where he is having the wealthy Chinese move money to accounts that he controls, where he sells the money again, so to speak, to Mexican companies often that need Chinese currency. Wow. And makes money off of that as well.
Why do they have to get most of their American currency illegally?
Well, there's very strict limits in China on movement of money out of China. It's about $50,000 a year, and so the problem is just that, you know, they have these fortunes in China that they want in the West, and there has always been a thriving underground banking system in China, you know, going back decades for that kind of thing, for moving money through the diaspora. But under the regime of Xi Jinping, there have been more restrictions, more of a crackdown on that kind of thing. And Xi Ji Li and others realized that was an opportunity for them, you know, because they had, you know, this seemingly endless supply of dollars on the streets of the United States that they could offer to these folks, who often use the money in the United States for things like buying real estate or even for paying university tuition.
What sort of evidence do federal agents have that these deals were happening with the knowledge, if not the direct involvement, of Chinese Communist Party leaders?
I think the best statement on that was expressed by Admiral Craig Faller, who was the head of the Southern Command, the U.S. military division that oversees Latin America. And he said that the Chinese government is at least tacitly supporting the laundering activity. That means at best they're letting it happen. And there's lots of evidence in this case and others of that level of what appears to be letting it happen. The amount of money that is moving through the Chinese economy, you know, in this case, it's believed to be hundreds of millions. You know, if you add it all up, it's hundreds and hundreds of millions, is moving through banks. It's moving through businesses. You have individuals, for example, Lee, among his dozens of couriers, had some couriers in Portland who they alone controlled over 251 bank accounts in China.
Wow.
And they're, you know, and the, as one of the investigators said, the sheer volume, intensity, consistency, frequency, nature of these complex transactions in a state like the Chinese state, which is the most sophisticated police state in the world, which not only controls activity on its own territory, but throughout its diaspora, it is hard to believe for many reasons that there was not an awareness of this. Beyond that, in the Lee case, there are specific evidence of high-level people in the Communist Party elite, of people in the government, benefiting personally from this, you know, among his clients were people in power. And there are also signs, for example, he also had a fraudulent document business, a thriving fraudulent document business in Latin America, that he was providing those services to people in the Chinese military and Chinese government, sort of criminal services there. The big debate, and we tried to be very careful in the story, is how much is this a concerted policy and how much of it is a lots of acts of individual corruption, you know, and sort of tolerance of this because it benefits people in power. There's a debate within the U.S. national security community about that, but, you know, most of the people, it's hard to believe that this is all just kind of happening, again, because of the level of control, which you see in many realms of life in China and in the diaspora. And the other thing we should add, you know, and that I think is clear, and the prosecutors say this in court documents in this case, the Chinese government very rarely, if ever, provides any assistance, you know, to U.S. law enforcement on these cases, right? So this is all happening. This is happening thanks to the access that Lee and other launderers have to the Chinese economy, the state-controlled economy, the state-controlled banks, where they seem to be operating, you know, kind of brazenly and with great impunity. They're operating rather openly on WeChat, which is a Chinese application for communications and for money activity, which is obviously encrypted as far as the U.S. government is concerned, but to which the Chinese government has access. And that's another big reason U.S. law enforcement feels that the Chinese authorities are at least aware of this. You know, they monitor WeChat aggressively, and a lot of this was going on WeChat, and it wasn't, you know, the investigators were surprised in this case when they were able to get access to confiscated devices that the WeChat conversations about the laundering and the drug trafficking weren't particularly coded or secretive. And then, of course, there is this 14K connection, this triad connection. There's quite a bit of evidence that in the past decade under Xi Jinping and his expansionist and aggressive regime around the world, that the connections between the Chinese state and Chinese organized crime around the world, which always existed for mutual benefit, have intensified. And the 14K triad to which Li was connected, its leader was publicly sanctioned, its leader in Macau, was publicly sanctioned by the United States and publicly accused of being not only a gangster, but a member of a conference related to the Chinese Communist Party, basically a Chinese Communist Party leader. And there were specific allegations about his role in activities overseas, combining business, crime, and the advancement of Chinese strategic objectives, co-opting elites in foreign countries, working with Chinese diasporas to establish control. There's a sense that Chinese organized crime acts as an instrument of the Chinese regime in many places, and that this kind of activity is tolerated or allowed because of the benefits to both of the players in that equation.
And of course, there's also this perception that facilitating the drug trade in the Americas is kind of a stealthy way to weaken the United States.
Right. And that, you know, that is a question of debate within the U.S. National Security Committee. There are definitely serious people, at, you know, veterans who I know in various agencies, current and former, frontline and senior, who feel, you know, and many of them admit they don't have the smoking gun proof, but, you know, who feel that this is a part of a strategy to weaken the United States, you know, and that the drug trade weakens the United States. And certainly, you know, if you combine the money laundering with the drug of the moment, which is fentanyl, you know, which has a remarkable death toll and which obviously is produced in China and which continues to make its way to the United States through Mexico from China, that's, you know, they point at that. Again, not everyone feels that way. And many of the people who make that allegation don't necessarily have smoking gun proof. Some of them say it does exist in classified intelligence. Others say it's more, you know, based on a logical analysis of the situation. Obviously, the Chinese government has denied it strenuously. But, you know, this, I think we try to raise some important questions and point at some important evidence that explains why some people think this way.
Sebastian, listeners may have heard that Xi Jinping has waged this very public anti-corruption campaign, but you let us know in the article, the point there was maybe less about eliminating actual bad actors than about purging Xi's detractors from prominent positions within the party.
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, most serious people I've talked to, people high up in the U.S. government, Chinese dissidents, and there's been a lot of public discussion and writing about this, feel that this anti-corruption purge, though it has been aggressive and has jailed a lot of people and has certainly, you know, cracked down on some corruption, that it has been selective and politicized, and that many of the people who have gone down have been people who are rivals of the current regime, and that there are people still in power who are still involved in corruption, and that things like this laundering still go on, and this remarkable movement of money out of China still go on. It has become harder, but it certainly hasn't stopped. So yes, there's definitely a sense in the national security community in the United States and Europe and among Chinese dissidents that this anti-corruption purge, while it definitely has teeth and while some people have definitely gone to jail, is as much of a political purge as anything else and is therefore selective and suspect.
What did you learn about the kind of demeanor of a figure like Xi Jinping, someone who is connected to multiple places and obviously built in a very short time this enormous operation?
I mean, he's a, you know, he and others like him are fascinating characters because, you know, they have to function, you know, within a system like the Chinese one, you know, which is where there's all this intrigue and all the you know, this state power at play. They have to deal with some of the most violent organizations in the world, like, you know, the Sinaloa cartel and the Jalisco New Generation cartel. And they practice strategic restraint, right? There isn't, curiously, this is an arena as violent as the cartels are. And I've covered all kinds of cartel violence, you know, for many years. In this arena, Xi Jinping and others like him were subtle and careful and good businessmen and had sort of the tradecraft of spies and largely avoided violence. And I think there was almost a sense among the cartels that they were, this was such a good deal, this is such a good deal, that they are careful to protect these operations. And you rarely hear about ripoffs or turf wars among these Chinese laundering organizations. So that was very interesting. There is one incident in Xi Jinping operated based in both Mexico and Guatemala City where he had a casino. And he does get ambushed in Guatemala City and his car gets shot up. But he believes that was the belief is among investigators that that was rival Asian traffickers and not Latin American drug traffickers. So it's interesting that he's someone who is slick, careful, restrained, subtle, and practices this kind of strategic restraint and was able to do this, you know, for a couple of decades. You know, again, the money laundering, document fraud. I mean, this is someone who was able to infiltrate the bureaucracies in Mexico and Guatemala and Suriname and in Belize and other places. He had a source to acquire passports that he would sell. In other words, real passports that were fraudulent to people. He had a contact in Hong Kong who provided passports to people. I mean, he had multiple criminal industries going on that he directed with great sophistication and prowess.
I have to say, Sebastian, the falsified documents thing is fascinating to me. it is hard to believe that it's still possible to create fake passports convincing enough to get people across borders. There are just so many checks out there. Do you know anything about how he was able to pass these off?
Yes. I mean, I think the important thing to remember is that these are not really, they're not fake. They're fraudulent. In other words, and I've covered this in separate cases in a place like Guatemala, what you have is bureaucracies that generate these passports that are so corrupt that you can buy a passport in Guatemala or in Mexico or in Suriname that is a real government issued passport, but it was issued fraudulently, whether under your name or an alias with your real picture and with the real, all those materials that go into the, as you say, the new technology that makes it harder to have a fake passport. But if it's a real passport that you got, but you shouldn't have gotten, then you're good, right? And that's what he was doing. And that was the genius of that business. And that's what made it appealing to people in intelligence services, there's at least one documented case of him selling a fraudulent document in Guatemala to a senior Chinese military officer. And the U.S. government became very concerned about this. And actually, the Diplomatic Security Service of the State Department has done its own investigation just on the fraudulent document business. And it's very much part of this international underworld that is really planetary in scope. Right, that someone like Zixi Li, you know, was very comfortable in, where he had this empire at its peak, which stretched from Canada all through the United States, Mexico, Central America, Colombia, China, and other Asian countries. These are people who are able to bounce around the world, and one of the ways they're able to do that is by having multiple passports and multiple identities. He had at least 5 passports from 3 countries, and I think 17 different aliases.
Is there any way to estimate how much of the cartel money laundering market ended up converting to this new system?
I mean, everyone asserts, the DEA has asserted, Southern Command has asserted that the Chinese money laundering organizations now dominate money laundering for the Mexican cartels and some of the other cartels from other countries as well. That doesn't mean there aren't other kinds of money laundering still going on in many places, but it's hard to estimate how much money the cartels make in a year, but it's thought to be in the billions. But the idea is that the lion's share of that is now laundered by these China connected groups, and largely through these schemes through the Chinese economy, which, as I was explaining earlier, involved not just the Chinese elite, but companies that are, many of them Latin American companies that are doing business in China that are buying sort of quote unquote this laundered money from people like Li, and using Chinese currency to buy goods and move them to Latin America, sometimes as part of laundering schemes directly with cartels to mask profits and things like that. So in Li's case alone, the U.S. government, for purposes of convicting him, the figure they established was $30 million, but the court documents and the interviews make clear it was in the hundreds of millions. So you multiply that by all the other groups that have surged to the forefront in the past decade as this quiet takeover has happened by the Chinese laundering groups, and you're talking about very big numbers.
Tell us about the operation it took to catch Li and bring him to justice.
And that was very interesting, because curiously, it starts out as an investigation in Memphis, Tennessee, by a relatively young rookie DEA agent, a very sharp, voracious investigator who's looking at, tracing back shipments that drug gangs in the Memphis area, cocaine that they're dealing, and through the markings on the shipments and through intercept programs that the Special Operations Division in headquarters is running, they were able to trace back the money to an organization that is known as Los Chinos, the Chinese ones, run by a very interesting woman drug trafficker known as La Dama de Hierro, the Iron Lady, Maricela Flores. And they're intercepting her communications and watching, seeing that she's an important transporter in Mexico for the Sinaloa cartel and other cartels. And they start seeing communications to the money laundering wing of her organization, so to speak. And they identify a woman, a Chinese-Mexican woman, whose nickname is Chinaloa, which is a combination of China and the state Sinaloa, which is the state where many Mexican drug traffickers, including Chapo Guzman, are from. But she is the girlfriend, the paramour of Zixi Li. And she is working very closely with him in laundering for the for Flores, for the Guzman cartel and others. And through those communications, this Memphis team starts to realize the dimensions of this, that they're seeing that this group, this Zizi Lee and Sinaloa and people around them are laundering all this money in Mexico and Guatemala, and they start connecting it back to seizures in the United States. And they're inside at least some of the communications, not all of them, but some of them, enough communications to then trace, realize that he and the people around him are directing all these money pickups and drop-offs and communications about money in the United States. And so they started mapping out this courier network and both discovering, watching the courier network as it operates and retroactively going back and realizing that past busts all connect back to the same organization. And they're seeing that, you know, when a dozen cities and dozens of couriers are working for Zizi Lee, and then they're seeing, you know, the aspect we described earlier, they're gradually piecing together the puzzle that, oh, this is money that is then being, you know, the role of the Chinese elite of people in the Chinese immigrant community receiving the money of the transactions overseas. They start to follow that. They see that there are certain people in the organization who travel back and forth to China and who are, you know, controlling, you know, multiple bank accounts in China and the United States. They start to sketch out, you know, the vast dimensions of this organization. And they start to, especially in the United States, they start to pick off loads and arrest key people and realize, you know, how much money is moving and start to understand the structure of this organization and to go after Zizi Lee himself.
You've also done extensive reporting on a business associate of Lee's, a guy named Dao Liu. How did he figure into this operation and what was their relationship?
This is a fascinating character, and for me, like the agents, this takes, you know, this investigation takes this bizarre turn into the labyrinth of high-level U.S. politics. But to try and simplify it, basically, the DEA agents managed to arrest Zizi Lee in 2020 in Mexico with the help of Mexican federal police, and they arrest most of his lieutenants, and they are going through his, you know, now they have a treasure trove of communications and devices to look at, and they discover that one of the key figures, particularly in the early years of the growth of this organization, so say from 2011 to around 2016, is this businessman, this expatriate Chinese businessman who was living in Mexico named Tao Liu, who first meets Zizi Lee because he's buying fraudulent documents from him. He wants to buy fraudulent documents. He collects fraudulent documents. And he's this very wealthy, mysterious character who, it becomes increasingly clear, played an important role in the rise of this organization. And in fact, in conversations that are intercepted later or recorded later, Tao Liu claims that he's the one who really taught Zizi Lee how to do this money laundering scheme. That may or may not be true, but the agents tend to believe him because he is someone who moves in a different world. He has criminal connections, but he's also very wealthy and has lots and lots of high-level contacts in the Chinese diaspora and the Chinese elite back home. And they believe that he is one of the people who helped Zizi Lee make contact with the market that was absolutely essential to the scheme, which was the demand side, the wealthy Chinese elite who were looking for dollars, right? So the agents start investigating Tao Liu and see that he was moving around in Mexico and Guatemala, playing a role in this money laundering, hanging out with Zizi Lee, gambling with him, all the, you know, crossing borders with him, buying fraudulent documents with him, you know, very, very shady, complicated character, again, with multiple aliases, multiple passports. But then, as they continue to reconstruct his trail and they start intercepting his communications and get inside his devices, they discover he's in Hong Kong. They reconstruct this whole bizarre chapter that starting in 2018, after he was in China and Fiji involved in some scams, high-level multi-million-dollar pyramid schemes, which he barely escapes, and he's supposedly wanted by Chinese authority. Everyone else involved in those scams gets caught in China, but he somehow escapes, makes his way to New York, and kind of reinvents himself as this financier who's rather mysterious, barely speaks English, but has all this money, sets up a venture capital fund, and very quickly sets out to meet important people in New York. He meets political figures from both parties, but he's particularly focused on the Republicans. He meets people in banking and finance, and he's sort of on this concerted what appears to be a political influence operation. And the agents are seeing pictures of him with important politicians at the level of state legislators in New York. But of course, what blows them away is that in 2018, he befriends people around Donald Trump and manages to meet not once, but twice with the President of the United States. And there are photos, which we obtained exclusively, where he basically, through an associate of Donald Trump, was able to gain access to the Bedminster Golf Club in New Jersey and meet with Donald Trump. There's pictures of a sit down sort of over food at the golf club. There are different versions about how long that lasted and what went on. This friend of Donald Trump who he used to gain access to the president, named Joseph Cinque, who talked to us, said first he said in an interview with Chinese television a few months after that event that it was a three-hour meeting and that Liu played a big role. Then he said to us, well, I was exaggerating. It was only about half an hour. And he didn't really say that much because his English isn't that good. But there is still this great mystery of, like, how does this guy get access, who was at this time a wanted criminal in China, right? And his crimes had been in the press in China. How does he get access to the president? And again, a couple of months later, he gets access again at Bedminster and spends time with the president, and this time with friends who are visiting from China, who may or may not have paid for the opportunity to get this kind of access and get in these photos. So the DEA is fascinated by this guy. They want to know, why is he meeting with these people? Why is he meeting? Because he also was meeting with people involved in campaign finance, prominent fundraisers for the GOP, at least three of them. We were able in our reporting to document at least one case where he made what appears to be an illegal campaign contribution through a U.S. citizen. And the suspicion is there were more of them. What is he doing? Is this the suspicions of the DEA are, is he involved not just in money laundering, but in legal financing? Is this part of a Chinese intelligence operation to gain access to American politicians? What is going on? So the DEA is trying to figure out how to get him, and they start a phone sting where he's in Hong Kong. This is during the pandemic, mind you, but they use an undercover officer who starts talking to him, who convinces him that he has a contact at the State Department where he has where he can get him fraudulent U.S. passports. And sort of real fake passports. And Talia jumps at this opportunity. And so the DEA is working this sting to try and get him out of Hong Kong. But then they discover, and here's where the story gets even more complicated, that the FBI had already been looking separately at Talia, because when in early 2018 he started, spreading money around and meeting all these people in New York and political circles, the FBI counterintelligence agents in New York became interested in him. And when he met with the President of the United States, they became even more interested in him, right? So there is a suspicion on the side of both agencies that this is someone who is connected to both crime and Chinese intelligence, that at some level, and that he's not just doing this. He may be doing this to get, photos with famous people, but that there's more going on. So there's a conflict between the DEA and the FBI. The FBI wants to keep watching him. The DEA wants to go get him. And the DEA ends up prevailing. And we tell the exclusive story of how they are able basically to this great Chinese-speaking undercover officer is able to convince him that he's going to send a private plane into Hong Kong, which is going to pick him up, take him to Australia. And in Australia, he's going to buy his new U.S. passport, which allow him to return to the United States, because he had left the United States under some haste, because a lot of his businesses turned out to be scams and he had kind of left in a hurry. So the DEA sends in a private plane, right, with undercovers on board. It picks him up in Hong Kong. This is a very daring operation, right, because this is, Hong Kong is essentially greatly under the control of the Chinese services, and this could cause a diplomatic incident. He comes aboard. They take him to Guam, which is the U.S. territory, and they arrest him.
Okay, this is all very complicated and fascinating, Sebastian. I have to ask you, though, this is a guy who has attracted the attention of the DEA and the FBI, and the question I have is, where the heck was the Secret Service? How does a foreign national with, sort of wanted on his criminal record in multiple countries, how was he able to meet and spend time with the sitting president of the United States without having been subjected to extensive background checks?
I mean, I had the same question, and at the first I was also kind of stunned by that. But, this has been reasonably well documented that the past president of the United States, whether you are for him or against him, I think it's pretty clear that the environment he created, and Mar-a-Lago is more famous in this case, at his golf clubs, Mar-a-Lago and Bedminster, created kind of a hole in the defenses, right? If you were a member of those clubs or a guest of the member, you could get access to him the way you couldn't to another president, not on his official schedule. And what the Secret Service says, and I think they make a pretty good case, is that if someone like Tao Liu had requested an official meeting with the president as part of government business, he would have been screened. And as you said, because he's a foreign national, he would have been aggressively screened. And it's hard to believe, because a diligent web search would have found his picture and his name, you know, being wanted by the Chinese authorities in these scams, right? Let alone, you know, more digging that might have found some of this other stuff we're talking about. That was public record. But because he goes in with a close associate of the president who has pretty, you know, open access to the president at the golf club during what's called off the record movements, that is downtime, when the president is sort of on his on time, going out of his living quarters at the Bedminster Golf Club and mixing with the public there, those people are not screened by the Secret Service. Those people are screened for weapons, right? The Secret Service makes sure that they, you know, aren't carrying knives or guns or poison, but they do not do background checks on those people necessarily. And that is how he seems to have, you know, just evaded screening. And it seems, you know, well established. And frankly, there have been other cases involving Chinese nationals in Mar-a-Lago, which have been in the press, where people with dubious connections and dubious intentions managed to get access to the president and people around him. So that's basically what happened.
It would seem that the stories of catching and convicting figures like Tao Liu and Xi Jili would represent victories for federal law enforcement agencies, for the Justice Department. Why have they mostly kept quiet about this, to the extent that you and your colleagues really had to do all the digging in order to make this story public?
You know, it's a very good question, and I've worked obviously on these kinds of stories for many years, and I've usually had good success with the agencies. At the sort of official level, getting some comment or getting some direction or guidance, you know, one way or the other, particularly in cases where, as you say, I mean, these people, by the time we did the story, had been convicted of money laundering, right? They and their, you know, just about everyone in the case except one person who's awaiting extradition has already been convicted. So you know, and everyone I talked to, and, you know, obviously we had lots and lots of sources, my colleague Chris Furstenberg and I, who talked to us, you know, unofficially, so to speak. But officially, the DEA, though, you know, it has publicly cited this money laundering as one of the most important, you know, sort of new threats in the landscape of drug trafficking, just did not want to talk about the case, saying that, you know, there were still open investigations, and did not even, for example, want to provide a general briefing on how the money laundering works, which is, you know, money laundering is pretty complicated, and I've, you know, worked with these agencies all over the world for many years, and usually they will at least help you on something like that to make sure you understand what you're talking about, right? But in this case, for whatever reason, there was just not a willingness to talk about this case. And, you know, obviously there is a politically sensitive aspect of it because it involves the former president of the United States. The FBI did not want to talk. Those reasons, I guess, are more understandable, because counterintelligence are always the hardest ones to talk about, because they are like a submarine that never comes to the surface, right? Unless there's a prosecution, you can be working a very serious counterintelligence case for years and never, it'll, none of it will ever become public, right? That's just that realm. But we found ourselves, you know, and I've done many difficult, complex international investigative stories. This was one of the most challenging I've ever done, because we had to really, you know, work sources, current and former. We had to work associates. We had to work social media. We had to do everything you can imagine to put together this story on our own. I mean, I'm pretty proud of the result, but I am still surprised and somewhat mystified that there wasn't more willingness to talk at least about parts of it, you know.
Sebastian Rotella is a senior reporter at ProPublica, where you can read his story, How a Chinese-American Gangster Transformed Money Laundering for Drug Cartels. Sebastian, this has been so interesting. I really appreciate you making the time to talk about it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much for taking the time.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for KERA Think. You can subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get podcasts, or you can listen at our website, think.kera.org, where you can sign up for our new newsletter as well. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.